what triggered this bizarre behavior.
Journey into the cold heart of Northern Darkness with Nordic Crimes.
That case became like a scene from a horror movie.
A new true crime documentary series that chilled the bone.
The hunger for killing is increasing in the course of these homicides.
Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Nordic Crimes is a part of the Acast family.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you put the dog in a warehouse and you got dozens of cars and alerts on that particular car, a jury is going to find that to be very persuasive.
Hello, and welcome back to 1 Minute Remaining. My name is Jack Lawrence, the host and creator of this show. Recently, we covered the story of DeAndre Lane, arrested, tried, and convicted for the murder of his 2-year-old daughter, Bianca Jones. It's a crime he's always maintained he's innocent of, and as we know, baby Bianca has also never been found. As always, once we wrap up a case, I like to bring in the big guns of law, the man they call the voice of reason, a man who has decades of trial experience as a defense attorney at Leonard Trial Lawyers in Chicago, Illinois, and of course, a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the American legal system. It's OMR's resident attorney, Michael Leonard. Let's speak of the latest story on OMR. Of course, DeAndre Lane, who has been sentenced for the murder of his daughter. A tricky one to navigate this one. A few touch points within this story that make it obviously an emotional one. Whenever a child's involved, you know, it's never nice. What are your initial thoughts, Mr. Leonard?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a couple twin killers about this story. It's just such a sad one. Not only do you have a child involved, but then you also have the allegations and obviously some truth to it of abuse of a child. So those things make it very difficult for the jury to hear the case and very difficult for the jury to keep an open mind and not be prejudiced, not to jump to conclusions.
Yeah.
Because especially in the States, I mean, nowhere is child abuse popular, but especially in the States, I think those things, those issues for jurors are very, very tough. And, you know, I don't know where we stand on the continuum of child abuse, but, you know, even the types of things that were described by him as, you know, more disciplinary, I think generally in our society, they're not accepted in the States, and they're things that would be very difficult for a jury to overcome.
As I said in the show, there's the dispute around disciplining of children and to smack or not to smack. But I think then when you add the element that he did of bringing in and this implement that he would use to discipline, he says just to sort of, in his words, pop him on the butt. But that's never going to look good to anyone, really. I think especially to a jury, as soon as they bring out this, you know, implement, paddle, whatever you want to call it, it's always going to set things off on a bad note straight away, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think that sort of idea that you had something specially designed for the discipline is troublesome. And again, makes it hard for the jury just to keep an open perspective on all the evidence they're hearing. So, yeah, another difficult aspect of the case.
Interesting with this case, obviously, you know, this little girl has never been found. Even the judge in this particular case, she did an interview about it after she sort of left the bench and she's no longer a judge anymore. And she said even in her lengthy career as a prosecutor and as a judge sitting on a bench, she'd never seen anyone sort of convicted of murder when no physical evidence, so to speak, was found, as in, you know, nobody was ever found.
Nobody ever saw baby Bianca killed. Nobody ever recovered the body. This is what we call circumstantial evidence, evidence which you can infer the existence of something else.
In her first public interview on the disappearance of Bianca Jones, Judge Evans tells us she was surprised there was a guilty verdict.
I was very surprised. This is probably the only case that I've had as a judge or as a prosecutor, which is in excess of 26 years combined, where there was a conviction that I knew of or that I was involved in without a body.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it is unusual. It's not certainly not unheard of that you could bring a murder case without the body. But a lot of prosecutors would have waited longer, I think, to charge the case and go ahead with it, to want to kind of run out every ground ball before they went ahead and charged. It seems like the case went to trial relatively quickly, which is kind of surprising in light of not having a body. But again, not unheard of that you would bring it, but certainly unusual and you know, relatively rare, certainly in our system.
The biggest thing around this case and the reason why he was arrested was around these cadaver dogs. I actually watched a show about cadaver dogs, and they actually specifically spoke about his particular case because it is an interesting one. Have you ever had anything to do with these dogs before and anything you've ever dealt with?
Well, not cadaver dogs, but we've very routinely run up against dogs that they use in the drug context. So a quite common scenario in the States is, you know, someone gets pulled over on the It's typically on a highway, a state highway, and then the law enforcement says there's some reason, they claim there's some reason to be suspicious, and then they bring the dogs and have them, you know, circle the car and then claim that they have alerted to the smell or alleged presence of a substance, and then they use that as the basis to go ahead and search the vehicle. And so we've dealt with that quite a few times, and then trying to suppress the search made by the dog. But it is a pretty well accepted thing, you know, to use the dog and to say that if it's certified, if it's trained, if its training's up to date, that they can go ahead and say that if it alerts to a particular area, that can be probable cause for a search. So it's very well accepted in the drug context. You don't see it in a lot of cases. Murder cases. I've actually never encountered a use of a cadaver dog, but it's like any other type of expert testimony. You know, the expert is the guy, the dog handler,
yeah,
who testifies about cadaver dogs and, you know, how they're trained and how they alert and all that sort of stuff. So it's compelling to a jury, I think, because, you know, they have an expert on the stand who's talking about the dog, who's the real expert. And it really gives the trappings of something that's very scientific. I'm troubled by it, you know, in the drug cases we have, because oftentimes, you know, they don't video what happened. And, you know, it is very true that dogs can alert for various reasons or to exhibit behavior that are not necessarily just indicative of what they're looking for. It could be a lot of different reasons. So there's certainly problems and limitations with the cadaver dog. However, in this case, you know, there's some compelling use of it. You know, if you put the dog in a warehouse and you got, you know, dozens of cars and alerts on that particular car, a jury is going to find that to be very persuasive.
Yeah. With the cadaver dog thing, I reached out to the gentleman who was involved in this case, but didn't hear back. But he was interviewed on this other show that I watched. And even he did say, you know, my dogs are trained to literally hit on anything that may have come into contact with that cadaver. And this dog didn't hit on anything in the house, really, apart from he sat down apparently in the bedroom, indicated on the car, but didn't indicate on DeAndre's clothing, on the couch where he supposedly sat this, you know, deceased child on. There was a number of areas in which the dog apparently paid no attention to whatsoever, which for me, again, is slightly troubling when apparently, you know, even the dog handler's like, he's trained to hit on anything that this cadaver or this deceased person or child would have touched.
Yeah, certainly there was a lot of fodder for cross-examination because there seems to be a lot of inconsistencies with where it actually alerted and then the prosecution's theory of the case. And, you know, I was troubled a little bit by the prosecution's theory of the case. It's kind of smacked as an old time prosecutor ranting and raving, you know, in the opening argument or closing statement, and just, you know, this whole thing with the blood and all that. And you know, when you're making those kind of arguments and they're not supported by the evidence, that's always troubling. and it's just like rabble rousing,
yeah,
or, you know, intentionally prejudicing the jury with facts that really are not supported by the evidence. But on the cadaver piece, yeah, I think there certainly was a lot. I don't know how good of a job they did on cross-examination. I haven't seen the cross of the dog handler, but clearly there was a lot there to use to show that, you know, the alleged alerting is inconsistent with the evidence and with the prosecution's theory, and a lot should have been made of that.
Seeing as you mentioned it, let's stick to the prosecutor for a moment and what their, you know, their theory of what happened. As we said there, the lady who was doing, I think, in her closing argument, she really went for it. She said he beat that baby to death, and she's whacking this stick on the table.
He took this stick and he beat that baby, and then he beat that baby till she was lifeless and bleeding, and he wasn't man enough to face what he did. He took her, he hit her, he got rid of her, and he threw her away like trash instead of manning up and admitting what he did to that child.
If he had, let's say if he had beaten this child to death with that stick, that would have created quite a substantial crime scene with blood everywhere, but there just was no blood to be found anywhere.
Yeah, I think it would have been more consistent with the evidence and a safer theory and a more consistent theory to say that he beat the child and the child died of the blunt force trauma rather than making up this whole idea that there was a bloody mess. Because you certainly could cause death with an object, this instrumentality that he had, by the blunt force trauma.
Yeah.
And I think that should have been the focus of the prosecution, to kind of make up something that had no support in the evidence, i.e. it was this bloody scene. That's just not supported by anything. So yeah, it's troublesome that when the prosecutor argues a theory of the case that's entirely inconsistent with the evidence, that bothers me, certainly.
Let's go back to DeAndre's version of events. I mean, he said he was carjacked and that, you know, they stole the car with his child inside it. You know, from anyone listening, and then, you know, he says that he sort of ends up at his Bianca's mother's house and he doesn't call police. He thinks he tried to call police, but he ended up calling his roommate. She testified that he did call her phone, but he was sort of crying and yelling indiscriminately and she couldn't quite understand what he was saying. He was just yelling, help me. You know, I think for anyone, they go, well, that sounds a bit odd, you know, this whole carjacking scenario. But it's not impossible.
Of course, yeah. And I got to give my honest reaction, as you asked for it. I didn't think it made a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, to target that car didn't make a lot of sense. To do it in the manner described, like the way the carjacking allegedly went down, didn't make a lot of sense. And then for the carjackers to then have the baby and to keep the baby and abandon the car, but keep the baby, it's just such a rare occurrence that almost never happens. And we've had, you know, the Chicago area is a great example. We have a huge carjacking problem, but just in any jurisdiction you can think of, there's always a case where there's a carjacking with a baby in the car, and 99.999 times, of course, the baby is recovered, because carjackers, if they really are carjackers, they want absolutely nothing to do with that kid.
Yeah,
of course. And they understand the consequences. They want to jack a car. They want nothing to do with a person in that car, which they know is going to cause intense scrutiny and criminal liability to them. So the whole story doesn't make sense to me. And then his reactions, again, of course, just like we've experienced in all sorts of cases you covered, we can't rule out that people act in bizarre manners when confronted with bizarre circumstances. But again, from a jury's perspective, the defendant sort of kind of wandering around, not running to a house or not going to 911 or law enforcement, from a jury's perspective, that's hard to buy.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody knows that it's possible, as we know from your show, as a good example, but is a jury going to buy that? I don't think so, and I'm sure they didn't in this case.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states.
UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Again, looking at the investigation that was done, there was a police officer who got up on stand and said that, you know, she was doing a routine call one day and she spots this child, and then, you know, she suddenly realizes, she gets back to the police station, sees a photo of baby Bianca, and she realizes this is the child. For some reason, she doesn't go straight to report it, but she eventually talks to some colleagues, and then she goes to report it to the investigators, and they apparently turned around to her and said, no, we've got the dad for this crime. The kid's dead. And they didn't follow up on that at all. The only person who did follow up on that was an investigator that was hired by the courts for DeAndre's sort of defense. He followed up on it. He reckons he went round, sees the child as well, reports it. It does eventually get followed up on. When they get there, though, the child is not there anymore.
I mean, for an investigative team or detectives to tell someone not to run out of lead because we already got him, that's the classic problem that you see in any case. And that's a giant red flag. Like, hey, we got our guy. Let's not chase down all the other leads that are coming. Always a problem. It's just a huge oddity in this case. And I don't know whether, you know, is it really possible that that really was the child? Of course, that's possible. Again, the jury would have to give weight to the ability of that member of law enforcement to make a legitimate identification for that really to be the kid. But there was no, of course, no reason under the sun that a legitimate investigation would say, don't run out that ground ball. Hey, guys, forget it. We got our guy. Let's not do anything more. That is a huge problem. I don't know if it tilts the wheel, so to speak, in favor of the defendant, but it's certainly a huge issue. I mean, I think the three things that I thought were most significant, one we already covered, which is the whole issue of the believability of the defendant's story. Obviously, you know, I, like many who would be jurors on the case, would have a problem with that. But then I thought the two other huge pieces of testimony were the girlfriend. I know she recanted, but the girlfriend saying she heard and agreed and knew that he had beat that specific child the night before her death. That was incredibly damning. That alone probably sealed the deal in the jurors' minds, particularly when she said that, you know, the next morning she never saw the kid. I know she changed her story, but her testimony under oath that that's how it went down is a huge problem for the defendant. And then I think another linchpin, if I was a juror, the testimony of the sibling or step-sibling who testified that the baby was completely covered, did not show any signs of movement, did not make any sounds. That would be highly persuasive to the jury, to have an 8-year-old kid up there on the stand who is sounded very credible, how they came across and testified, and, you know, very childlike and describing the absence of movement or speech on behalf of the baby. That would be, I think, you know, nail number three sort of in the coffin. And then I think you add the expert testimony from the cadaver dog. Again, it's problematic in certain ways, but those kind of four linchpins, I think, make a difficult case and make it not surprising that the jury reached the conclusion that they did.
Interesting one, a sad story, of course, but you know, as always, Mr. Leonard, I appreciate your thoughts and feelings on this one. I do appreciate your time.
Hey, I wanted to ask you, did you see the multi-part, I think it was Netflix, about the murders that occurred in Australia in the 70s.
No.
Did you watch that series?
No, I don't think so.
I thought it was pretty well done. It's like maybe four parts. I don't know what city that was in Australia, but there were a bunch of young women who were in their 20s who were killed by a serial killer in Australia. So the something town murders. They're all from one city in Australia.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
And it just brought home again, you know, because we were saying a minute ago, hey, we're not surprised what happened here. But that Australian series, you know, a bunch of young women were targeted by a serial killer, killed, and it couldn't be solved. But for years, law enforcement and the public and everybody in Australia believed it was this one guy. Everyone was certain it was him because he drove around the area. He actually admitted to giving some of the women who were killed rides, and everybody believed it was him, and it turned out not to be him. They were completely wrong for like a decade, destroyed the guy's life essentially, and then they found the real killer. So it's like, it's just amazing that, you know, you can hear a set of evidence and of course reach what you think is the only reasonable conclusion. And everybody was convinced in Australia, especially law enforcement, that that was the guy, and they were dead absolutely wrong. If you get a chance, take a look at that one and let me know what you think.
You know what you've done to me here, though, because would you know what the name of the show is called?
No, it's the something.
Because, you know, if I put this out without the name of the show, I'm going to get bombarded by our listeners going, what's the show that he's talking about? And because just like I did when people sent me thousands of photos of that food you told me about, whatever that was, the Sloppy Joe's. Get an email of Sloppy Joe's photos everywhere because of you.
All right, here, how about we do this? I'll find it tonight.
Good.
I'll send it to you. You can have a postscript to our discussion.
I will.
Because I think that it was well done, plus I'm sure your viewers would really be interested. I'm sure a lot of them are aware of the case.
You have 1 minute remaining.
As always, a huge thank you to Michael for his insights and thoughts on this case. And for those wanting to watch the show Michael was raving about just then, he did in fact message me and tell me that it is called The Claremont Murders. So for those in Australia, you will probably already know. Those outside of Australia, it's following the story of three young women who vanished from the same suburb in Perth. And it's a great illustration of how investigators can become fixated on one particular person. So you can check that out right now, which is on Netflix. And no, we're not sponsored by Netflix. 1 minute remaining is a Mashed Pumpkin production, created, hosted, and produced by Jack Lawrence. Audio and sound design by Jack Lawrence and Dom Evans of Earsay.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.